Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The 1990s are about to officially end on the nation's highways. GM has announced it will end production of the giant Hummer H1. And a stampede of stylish, sporty, gas-sipping tiny cars is headed onto the American roads. Not yet the teeny tiny cars of Europe, those are coming, but a rush of small subcompacts with miles more power and finish and flair than their 1970s oil crisis ancestors ever had. We know that somewhere in the back of your mind as you dump $50 worth of gas into a fill-up, you're wondering what it would be like to drive tiny. Today, we'll tell you and look at the options and the future. Up next on Point, road testing a whole new generation of tiny cars. Later in this hour, we'll hear from the inventor of the super small Tango, an electric car, two-person that goes 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. George Clooney drives one. Plus, we'll hear from a head designer at Ford and from an MIT researcher who wants to stack microcars like shopping carts for the taking. Talk about grab and go. But first, with me from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Larry Webster, technical director of Car and Driver magazine. He's test-driven the new fleet of tiny cars hitting the American roads. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Hi, Tom.
Hi, it's great to have you. So there's a whole new flock out there. We've gone to something like a half dozen subcompacts available to 10 in the last few months. I mean, we're in the midst of this. Is it all driven by gas price, Larry?
Well, no, it's actually really interesting. A lot of the cars that you remember as subcompacts, like the Honda Civic, the Nissan Sentra, they've grown over the years.
Yep.
So it turns out that as those cars have gotten bigger, they've left this hole at the small end of the market, and we're seeing the automakers filling that end is basically what's going on.
Larry, we're also joined from New York. We almost lost him to a traffic jam. That'll have to change someday. Let me introduce Phil Patton is with us. He writes about cars for the New York Times and Wired magazine. He's also author of A Cultural History of the Volkswagen, Bug, the Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. Phil, we're glad we finally got you off the highway.
That's called irony, Tom.
Yeah, I guess. Larry, you've been driving this new gang. Compare them to what we knew before. It's not the first time there have been tiny cars on the American highway. After the oil crisis in the 70s, there was a whole flock of them. My first car was a Ford Fiesta from the repo man, not because of the gas mileage. It's all I can afford. But this new gang, how do they compare to what Americans of a certain age will remember?
Well, I mean, it's certainly not across the board. These new small cars are terrific, but there are some definite standouts. Now, we remember small cars as something that we call them penalty boxes. You know, they were tinny, they were noisy, they were slow. You felt like, gosh, if somebody hits me, I'm a sitting duck in this thing. But actually, the new cars turn out to be much more refined. They're a lot more comfortable. They're not like the rolling traffic cones that they used to be. So we're finding that as these new cars get into the market, that they're just a lot better overall vehicle, especially, like you said, the Honda Fit. It's really a terrific car. It's not expensive. It's refined. You won't feel like you're driving something cheap.
Now, Phil Patton, we're not down to Euro-sized cars yet. Now, some of this terminology is new to me, but there's what A cars and B cars. A's, the micro cars that you can see all over the place in Europe. We're not there yet, but we're down to a B, which is a pretty tiny car here in general.
Yes, the Bs are quite common in Europe, and that's what we're getting now. The As, when you think of like the Smart, that really is just too much of a shrinkage for the American. It's just too frightening to be out there with the 18-wheelers and the Suburbans.
Well, that's the big question, and let me ask you, Phil. When you get into these tiny cars after a decade of getting reaccustomed to big cars. I mean, I first grew up driving pickup trucks and huge old Chevys before my own little Fiesta there. Those came back like crazy in the 90s. Does it feel scary to drive a tiny car on the highway today, Phil?
Well, it really does depend on where you are. The small cars are just fine scooting around suburbia in New Jersey. I drove a Yaris from New York down to Washington. That was fine on the highway and in Georgetown and in the suburbs. But to be alone between, say, Las Vegas and Reno in a fit is not necessarily where I would like to be. It really does have to do with the landscape, and that's been the one of the reasons over the years that we've resisted these so much.
Larry, what are we seeing in terms of sales? I'm looking at some numbers here that look like it's a pretty big takeoff for these cars. I mean, enough Americans find themselves in circumstances where that tiny size is not an issue, that they're snapping them up.
Well, what's really interesting is that if you knew what kind of accident you were going to be in, you could pick the car you wanted, because it turns out that not every car is perfect for every accident. Okay, so if you're in an accident with another car, yeah, you probably want to be in the bigger one. However, if you're in a single car accident, you want the lighter, smaller one. So it's not, you know, it's not totally cut and dry that the bigger car is safer. And I think people are starting to realize that, and they're also starting to appreciate that driving those big cars, it's not so much fun. And these little agile cars that are easy to park, they're easy to maneuver, and they got plenty of room inside are making some inroads.
Larry, take us into one or two of these models as viscerally as you can. Describe how they might compare to the subcompacts of yesteryear, how they compare in terms of fit and finish and feel to the cars most Americans, the larger cars most Americans are driving now.
Yeah, okay. Well, our favorite is this Honda Fit. It's new. It's about $15,000. It's a five-door. It kind of looks like a tall, kind of short wagon. And you open the door, and you're sort of greeted by very high-quality materials inside of there. I mean, the seats feel good. The dash fit and finish is terrific. You close the doors. You don't get any kind of hollow clunk. It feels solid. And then when you start moving down the road, the thing actually, it steers really well. It's quiet. You don't hear any buzzing. Nothing is vibrating inside. And it's just sort of a nice overall experience. Plus, it has some handy features like the rear seats fold flat and they fold forward, so you got a lot of room inside. But when you raise those seats, those seats fit adults. I mean, these are really practically roomy cars.
So it's tiny, but doesn't feel like a toy car on the inside. Phil, have you been there? What do you see in the Fit, or what do you like to drive?
The Fit is very clever, and one of the things they've done is get essentially the interior space of their larger Accord inside the length of a Fit, and that really changes the equation for people looking to use the thing as a practical vehicle. And cars like the Mini have really changed the game and expectations.
You're talking the Mini Cooper, the very flashy little BMW model?
Exactly. That's even shorter than the cars we've been talking about, the Yaris or the Fit. And people have looked at these where style is driving them and found that the cars in this class are no longer the hair shirt hatchbacks of the Jimmy Carter era, but they're very thoughtfully designed, and they're agile and quite satisfactory for most people's use, especially young people who, after all, have grown up with small cell phones and small iPods and small, intense cups of coffee.
What about fuel here, Phil Patton? We've heard so much about hybrids, but as I look at it, in many cases, just a good subcompact may get as good or better mileage than a hybrid.
Well, exactly. You get very good mileage simply because of the smaller size, not necessarily to equal those of hybrids. But in Europe, a lot of the B-class cars are also equipped with diesels, which get, as a rule of thumb, about a third better mileage. And if we had some of those here, we could rapidly improve our averages, our cafe numbers, as they call them. And that's what has been Europe's solution to this issue over the years. If we wanted to do one thing to change consumption numbers as quickly as possible, it would probably be to let some of those vehicles come in.
To let the really small ones, Larry, are those on the way, the smart and the super, super tiny cars of Europe? Will we see those on American highways?
You know, I don't think so. They are. I've driven them. They are a little bit intimidating to be on American highways with them, but Smart has been going back and forth with that car and whether they're going to bring it or not. I think currently they're saying they're not. You know, the big difference between Europe and here is the cost of fuel. There's a lot of taxes for fuel in Europe. It costs about double, and that's really the right way to drive demand for fuel-efficient cars. The way we do it here is really backwards, where we have this CAFE system where we tell the automakers they have to sell a certain number of cars with a certain fuel economy because, you know, the car companies know how to sell cars. Really, the government doesn't. So we always say, look, fuel economy is a noble and perhaps a worthwhile endeavor, but the way to do it is increase the price of fuel. And today there's really not a big penalty to pay for driving a fuel-efficient car.
But people are jumping in here for these. I saw last year sales of subcompacts up 4.4%. Projected this year sales to grow 54% to around 350,000 or so. That's a lot of subcompacts, Phil.
It's right, and Larry's absolutely right about the issue of taxing gasoline. But we look for the numbers of young people growing, and Ford in their Reflex concept, which they showed in Detroit and I wrote about in ID Magazine this month, took a look at what the future could hold in this segment. And if you take a turbo diesel hybrid, the best of all the technologies, and put that in a small car, realistically, within a few years, you could be looking at something that could get in the 50 to 60 mile per gallon, and you get fairly known technologies, and they tried to design it to give it a kind of tougher, more macho look that might be different from the traditional cuteness we associate with these cars. So they're taking a real look at how to make these things commercially viable in that segment.
We're going to be talking with the designer of the Ford Reflex in a few minutes here. Right now, we're joined from Spokane, Washington, by Rick Woodbury. He's president of Commuter Cars Corporation. He's inventor of the Tango, an ultra-narrow, freeway-capable, electronic, all-electric commuter car. He sold the first ever, or gave it, I'm not sure, to George Clooney. Rick Woodbury, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
I'm looking at your car, and it's something else. I'm not sure how to describe it. It's very narrow. It's tall. And I'm looking at it here, peeling out. This thing goes from 0 to 60 in 4-something seconds. Is that serious?
That's correct.
It's a concept car, or you've got a couple of them built. I mean, I know George Clooney has one on the road.
Right, and he did have to buy it. He paid $108,000 for it, plus shipping, and so...
Oh, good for you. So
yeah, no freebies from us at this point. We're trying to build a company.
He's voting with his dollars. You're hoping to get a lot of these into production. Describe the car for us, Rick.
Sure. First, I'd like to, if I may, start out with kind of some statistics to show what a breeding ground we have for a revolution in automotive history. And first of all, there's 118 million. These figures are a couple years old, but there's 118 million workers in the U.S., and 92 million of them, approximately 80%, drive all by themselves to work. The rest is, you know, motorcycles and walking and public transit, which is 6%.
So most of these are one person per car, though your car, this tall, narrow, super-fast Tango, would take two front to back like a motorcycle ride.
It does, but, you know, I think that people, when they're going out with someone else, they probably want to be side-by-side for communication.
So you're saying there's a lot of people out there who could use a car like this, but paint a picture of it for us. It's a very unusual vehicle.
Well, first of all, you know, as there are 80% of the people are by themselves in a car every day, it would seem that a second car, a commuter car in any family, should be one that does that job better than any other car. This is the only car in the world that's available that you can drive in a half a lane with more clearance than a truck has in a full lane.
You're saying you could actually take all the highway lanes in America and divide them in half again and pour Tangos onto them?
Well, in a sense, yes, exactly. I mean, you can double the capacity of a given lane. You can more than double it. And this study has been shown by University of California Transportation Department and Booz Allen Hamilton, who did a study with a GM car called the Lean Machine. And they showed how you could get actually 4,700 cars per hour as opposed to 2,000 cars per hour per lane.
It's so tall, it's narrow, it's fast. What keeps it from tipping over, Rick?
Well, the car is quite heavy, actually, and you know, in the last part of the session, I noticed you were talking about, you know, how does it feel up against all these other cars?
Mm-hmm.
We know that small cars are scary in general, so the first perception is, oh my God, it's a death trap. This car weighs more than a Civic or more than most cars, up to the point of a mid-sized sedan. It's 3,050 pounds.
Because of that electric battery in its base.
Right. The batteries are actually 1,100 pounds of batteries, and there are actually 2,000 pounds of weight under the floor of the car. However, for the strength up above, there are four times more steel bars in the door, for example, than there is in any other production car that I know of. Even a Volvo or Mercedes that really advertise strength and crash protection. Our car has a complete NASCAR roll cage or a NASCAR-style roll cage. NASCAR has to approve each one. This one actually meets SCCA race car regulations, and it passed FIA regulations worldwide.
Well, it looks like a rocket ride. Seats front and back, tall, incredible speed here. How do you get that 0 to 60 in four-something seconds from an electric car?
Well, because we use the same kind of motors that freight trains use. They're smaller, of course, but they each develop more torque than a Dodge Viper. So we have over 1,000 foot-pounds of torque. So in fifth gear, we can take off 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, quarter mile in about 12, and about a top speed of 150, all in one gear.
Well, I've heard a sighting from L.A. of George Clooney driving it and people saying turning heads all over the place. Listeners, if you want to see the Tango and a whole lot of these cars we're talking about, you should go to our website, onpoint.org. Big gallery of images there. Yes, is that Larry?
Yeah, I'm curious. What kind of range do you get in the Twingo? Like, how long can you go on a charge, and how long does it take to recharge it?
Well, recharging can theoretically be done in 10 minutes to 80% with lead-acid batteries. The range is around 50 miles with race tires. We'd be able to get about 80 miles with low rolling resistance tires. So there's some decisions you make when you buy the Tango as to how much range you need. I'd like to point out that these 92 million people that drive by themselves to work every day in this country drive an average of 20 miles. And even in L.A., they drive an average of 37 miles, which is well within the range of lead-acid batteries, even with the race tires on them.
Rick Woodbury wants to see you driving a Tango, and you can drive it fast. I'm looking at an image here of it peeling out. There's video at our website as well, onpointradio.org. Check out the image. Rick Woodbury, we wish you good luck with the Tango, getting a lot more of them out there. That would be a new world indeed. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I want to turn to our callers. Michael's on the line from Washington. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. This is Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know? What are you driving?
Well, actually, I don't even own a car. But as someone who cycles to work, I was looking at a subcompact, and if I wanted something with performance, so I sort of settled on the Mini Cooper S, but because it is the smallest that's out there, and I guess second place comes to the Subaru WRX.
Have you test driven these, Michael?
Yes, I have.
How's it feel?
I have friends who have the Mini Cooper, and it's fantastic.
Can you imagine going, I don't know, cross-continental, or do you see it as a commuter car?
Oh, I see it both easily, and look, and seriously, looking at the convertible, of course. But and with that, it just feels like you're on a bicycle anyway. So,
right, out on four wheels, not two, but nice and small. Good luck with it, Michael. Let me turn to Dana, calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Dana, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah,
I heard you talking earlier about modern Americans feel comfortable in the small cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty big American. I'm 6'1", 290 pounds, and I drive a Chevy Aveo.
And that's one of the new generation of subcompacts. How's it work, Dana?
I love it, and I've driven it long distance. I've taken it on 1,000-plus-mile trips, and I've had no issues with it. It's great. It's great gas mileage, and I fit perfectly.
290, and you're driving an Aveo, you know, lay off the cheeseburgers or you'll outweigh your car there. I mean, that's a really little car.
It's small, but I fit fine. One of my buddies who's we work out together, he's the same size as me. We took it on a trip down to Jersey, and it was great.
How's the leg room, Dana?
Yeah, for the front seat, it's fine. I mean, I wouldn't want to be myself in the back.
and you probably won't, but it's a great report. Thanks for calling in with it. Larry, what about the Chevy Aveo? How does it stack up?
Well, I tell you, I'm curious to what other cars he's driven, because certainly that car will get you anywhere you want to go. But will it be comfortable? In my opinion, it's not something I'd want to take on a long trip. That is on the tinny scale of small cars, in my opinion.
So, but Dana's done it, and he says he's ready to do it some more. Phil, what makes a tiny car? What's the line between compact and subcompact in terms of weight, size?
Well, I don't think there is any firm line. I think the point Larry made at the beginning, that most of our categories of cars have grown, that if Dana fits in that Aveo, that should be just fine. The Aveo is actually the best-selling of all this new group of the B cars that we're discussing, because it's at a lot of Chevrolet dealerships. But they're not being pushed by most of the traditional Detroit makers at this point. I think once people get inside these vehicles, again, when you're talking about one person or two people, a young couple, the space can be perfectly satisfactory. And as we know, a lot of the space that we think we have in big SUVs is not truly very usable. It's much more about image and feeling of bulk and security than about usable space or about legroom.
The space may be in there, but you're not necessarily part of it yourself. Larry, what about price? I mean, that's a big deal here. The SUVs have gone way up high. These cars start under $10,000. That's a different range.
It's not quite. Most of them are between $10,000 and $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Aveo is selling well because it is. You're right; it's very cheap. But you know, in my opinion, it kind of feels cheap. It's not to the level of, let's say, the Ford Focus or the Honda Fit or the Nissan Versa.
We've seen these funny ads for the Toyota Yaris, where it's going around sipping gasoline out of every crevice and gas can. Have you driven that one, Larry?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, like I said, it's a completely acceptable car. And it's one of those you have to test drive it to find out what's important to you. But, you know, I've driven 6-7 of these types of cars. And that one, to me, it just doesn't feel refined enough. It doesn't feel special enough. It's just kind of a small, cheap car.
But even with that, they're looking at sales going way up this year. And I'm looking at one critique here that says it has more front leg room than the BMW huge 7 Series sedan. I mean, that's hard to picture, but I guess it's there. Let me take a call from Ann in Wayland, Massachusetts. Hi, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I have been thinking about getting one of these B cars for our family. We're a family of four. Mm-hmm. We currently have two cars. You know, with our children, we do need a lot of space sometimes. I currently drive a minivan, but, you know, I would estimate that 90% of my trips, I don't need a car of that size.
Right.
And what I've been wanting to do is park my older minivan and not use it most of the time when I don't need it, and get a third car that gets great mileage. And I actually feel like I could consider this now, because some of these smaller cars are offering great safety features that they never did before.
Why a third car? Why not get rid of one of those first two for the little guy?
Well, you know, my husband sometimes has to take clients in his car, so he needs a reasonable back seat. I think we do for the children as well. So we could, but, you know, as it is now, we're going to drive our current cars till they absolutely die.
Right.
But I'd love to be able to acquire that third car, and I think it's important for overall consumption of gasoline in this country and global warming and all that, to for the average family to reduce the number of gallons per year they use.
Well, certainly with this kind of mileage, it would make a huge difference if you get in
big
numbers.
I've got a good idea for her.
Larry?
Yeah, it's called the Mazda 5. It's sort of like a mini minivan. It's got the sliding door. It's got three rows of seats, but it's got a four-cylinder engine. It's a lot smaller. Of course, it won't have as much room as your minivan, but it's fairly good-sized car inside, and it'll be good on gas.
Ann, thanks very much for your call. Good luck with that. I want to turn now to Dearborn, Michigan, and Peter Horbury. He is Ford Motor Company's Executive Director for Design in North America. There's a job. From 91 to 02, he was design director for Volvo, had a big hand in its transition from the old boxy style to the sleeker new design in Volvo. He has overseen design of the Ford Reflex, high-performance compact car, runs on turbo diesel fuel, 65 miles per gallon it's supposed to get, premiered at the 06 North American International Auto Show in Detroit. It's a really, really sporty-looking model. Peter Horbury, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi.
Where do you see the tiny car move going here? Detroit's never really loved it. Is it the future?
Well, I think so. I think America is turning to small, let's say. If you look at other products that people buy, especially young people, they buy their telephones. The smaller they go, the more you pay, you know, for smaller and lighter. If you look at cameras, for digital cameras, you can pay so much and get one of a medium size, but if you pay a little more, you can get one even smaller. And the MP3 players would never have been quite so popular had they been the same size as Sony's original Walkman. So I see a definite trend in the youth of America in paying a little more for something which has all the features of the bigger version, but in a smaller package.
Your Ford Reflex is a hot-as-a-pistol sports car design here. When do you hope to see it on the road?
Well, it's just one of the ideas we've been using, designing and showing in public, just to gauge opinions. We wanted to show people that small didn't just mean practical in the normal sense, although this sporty car has a lot of practicality in the fact that it's big enough for three adults or two adults and two children. So we just wanted to show that small is not boring, small can be exciting and sexy, and I think that's just one of the ideas that we'll be looking at in the future.
And what about small, straight-ahead gas-powered car versus the hybrids? I mean, clearly some of these get as good as, mileage as good as or better than hybrids. How do you see the future unfolding, you know, conventional versus hybrid in the small arena?
Well, yeah, the Reflex, as you said, was a diesel hybrid, which is a very exciting powertrain. I mean, diesels have had a bad press in America, I think, for too long, whereas in Europe, something like 70% of the market is diesel, and modern-day diesels are clean, quiet, and very fast. So, you know, maybe one day the diesel will catch on here.
And a diesel hybrid, Peter, that means you fill up with diesel and you have an electric backup?
Yes. The diesel engine drives the car in normal use, but when you're in slower traffic, the electric motors take over, and the diesel engine is generating electricity. So a very, very efficient way of driving. But as you said, the normal gas small cars, B cars, as it were, mm-hmm. they do have good mileage. So, you know, we can start off with those, and then maybe later on we can use the hybrid technology, which we use on bigger cars in the range, and we'll be using a lot more of in the future.
Let me take a call from Steve in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Steve?
Well, last year my family spent a vacation in Italy, and we got to drive a Ford Focus with the diesel engine, and it was a great car. I got 50 miles to the gallon again and again. And it had a whole lot of pickup. In town, I could get rubber in second gear with a family of four in the car, okay? It would really move because it had an intercooled turbocharged diesel engine in it.
A family of four plus the luggage of a vacation. Did you fit?
Yeah, it was a Ford Focus, just like you can buy here, but it had that diesel engine, and we loaded it all in the back. It was a station wagon. It was a great car, and it kills me that you can't get it here. I mean, I've bugged Ford about it, and you don't get anywhere when you try that.
Well, we'll bug them again right now. Thanks for calling, Steve. Peter Horbury, you're Executive Director for Design in North America. Why don't we have all those cars that are on the road in Europe over here in the U.S.?
Well, the Europeans have taken to the diesel technology much, much quicker than we have in America. I mean, there have been a few false starts, I think, for diesel here in cars. And as I said, they have they've gained a sort of unfortunate reputation for being slow and noisy.
But never mind diesel. What about the rest of your little cars over there? Why don't we get those, the A cars, the really tiny ones, and your fancy models?
We are starting to look at that seriously now. Obviously, the Focus has been here for some time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same size as the one in Europe. And I think it's just a matter of time that we will see a lot more smaller vehicles.
Peter Horbury, thanks so much for being with us. Right now, Amy's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling to ask about the, smart car. I live in Buffalo, New York, and it's 15 minutes away from Canada.
Right.
And if I drive 15 minutes up to Canada, there are people driving these smart cars all over the place. And I actually found out about it living in my area. Someone managed to buy one and use it in the States. And so I've been stalking it for about the past 6 months.
So if it were here, would you grab one?
Absolutely. I've gone over the border, tried to test drive one. I've been following the case online as to, you know, the decisions that are being made to bring them here.
And why aren't they? Amy, let me ask Larry Webster. Larry, describe the smart car for us. Who makes it and why it's not here if it's right across the border?
Well, it's made by Mercedes-Benz, actually owns Smart, and it's a puny little car. It's basically front to back. It's just long enough to fit two people and a small little hood. The engine's actually kind of underneath the rear passenger or cargo compartment. So
yeah.
This is one of those cars you could park nose into the curb on the street and you'd still be fine. So it's quite small. I don't know what their current thinking is. They keep going back and forth. I still think that it probably wouldn't sell in the volume that would make the investment of bringing it here worthwhile. Because don't forget, the two best-selling vehicles, even the beginning part of this year, were the Ford pickup and the Chevy pickup.
Yeah, yeah. So it's Mercedes' own decision. It's not American regulations or anything else.
Right. And
Smart does inspire incredible affection among people. It does suggest that style and personality is really important in these smaller cars. They do fit, too, to a parking spot, so their advantage is not unlike the Tango we were discussing in terms of size. But the Smart is in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, the only current production car that is, and that sort of design philosophy in somewhat bigger version might very well be practical with folks like our caller if it were here. And Mercedes-Benz has gone back and forth and had a lot of reaving of conscience about whether to bring the car here.
It is really, you could say, it is beautiful. You can see it at the website, onpointradio.org. Amy, if you had one in the U.S., how would you use it?
Oh, well, I wanted to mention, right now I currently drive a Hyundai Accent, which I bought used for about $2,000.
Okay.
And I've never had an interest in purchasing a new car until I saw the smart car. Like, I would pay the $15,000 to drive this. I think it's a political statement. I love the efficiency of it. I love the fact that you can convert it for use with, I believe, biodiesel. I'm thrilled about it.
Would you drive it on the highway? What about when that big Hummer or super pickup is next to you?
Well, I try to avoid the Hummer or super pickup. And the design, once again, is kind of smart. They, you know, the engineering looks, you know, like it's been well planned and everything.
Oh, yeah.
So I trust it.
There's a vote for Super Tiny. Amy, thanks for calling in from Buffalo. We hope you get one day. John's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, great show. I'm calling for, first, our family is a family of four with two dogs, and we drive a turbocharged Volkswagen diesel Golf that gets 45 to 50 miles per gallon, and it is so great. We've had it since 2002. But why I'm calling is one of my research areas, I'm a professor, is in the area of conservation and health.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a direct relationship between the obesity epidemic in America and the large cars. Because as we've gotten bigger, no one realizes they're bigger because everything around them is bigger. The cars, the clothes, even the caskets we're buried in.
Well, so you want cars like tight jeans that when you put on 5 pounds, you feel it.
Right. So let's prescribe smaller cars for larger people so that they realize they have to help our health crisis.
You think we'll actually end up healthier, not just the ozone layer, but right at the belt line, John?
Well, I write and publish a lot about conservation health, the relationship between the two, and I think there's a direct relationship.
I think you're onto something there. Larry?
I like it. I think that's a great idea because certainly people like SUVs because they're perched up high. They have a ton of room, usually useless room, like Phil said, over your head. And so, I mean, small cars are typically more fun to drive, too.
I want to talk about a kind of small car that's not on the road yet, but if it ever is, it's going to be a car like no other. I'm joined in the studio right now, Phil and Larry, if you'll stand by for a moment, by Ryan Chin. He's a doctoral student at the MIT Media Lab. He works on the stackable concept car in the Smart Cities Project. He's got a background in structural engineering and architecture. Ryan, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at some big pictures of your cars, and there are more at our website, onpointradio.com. You can see a video of this concept car and how it would work. And it literally is, these are cars that would stack up along the street like grocery carts or like luggage carts at the airport. They kind of collapse on themselves to stack into a nice, neat line here, sort of a bubble car, room for two. Describe this car for us, Ryan, and what it would do, how it would work.
Yeah, it's a stackable car. It's a shareable car. So we're moving into a shared ownership model.
So I wouldn't own this one. No. I'd simply have access to these stacks wherever, whenever I needed a car.
Right. They'd be conveniently located outside, for example, subway stations, the airport, places where there'd be a lot of people. And you never need to worry about taking a car out of the middle of the stack. You just take the first one. And what we're pushing for is a stackable car to save on footprint in the city because we want to save on space.
Well, I mean, these things, you could, I don't know, it looks like you could put six or eight in the space of one of those big pickup trucks.
That's right. That's right.
Electric or gas?
Electric vehicle. The stack, when it's in the stack position, is actually charging the vehicle. And so we don't need a lot of battery storage because we want to charge them in quick time. There's actually very...
The stack is charging. Now, wait a minute. Is there a plug somewhere? I don't see that in the picture. They charge each other, or how's it work?
They will be charged inductively. So you go over a plate. It could be over a plate, or they can plug into the ground, into the power grid.
So at the kind of parking zone where you stack these up like grocery carts, they'd be sitting on a power source.
Right. And as you park them behind each other, they plug in series. So as the car that comes in the back of the stack gets to the front, it's fully charged.
What kind of range?
The range will be city range, 50 to 60 miles per 60 miles.
So this is not for over the river and through the woods to grandmother's
No,
house.
But definitely going to the airport and definitely going to the grocery store and places where you need it in the city.
Are you getting commercial interest? Do American automakers, new or old, want to make this car?
General Motors is the sponsor of this project. They're a sponsor of our laboratory. And we are getting lots of interest from not only General Motors themselves, but also governments throughout the world. We look at internationally as well, governments in Asia, for example. Can't name them, but definitely we're moving into that
realm. And to speak to us anthropologically, you know, Americans kind of like my car,
sure,
with my air freshener and my, I mean, you name it, you know. Are Americans going to share cars this way on a large scale? Do you have reason to think they will?
Well, I think this is a new vehicle type. It's not something that's going to replace your personal vehicle. So you'll still own your vehicle, but when you're getting around the city, this is the vehicle that you might want to take. The other aspect that we're pushing for is a personalizability or customizability in the vehicle. So what we'd like to do is study the profiles of people and then be able to customize the vehicle either ergonomically using displays on the outside so that the car would configure to your preferences.
While I'm in it, it might light up in a different color or with a different signage on the back electronically
or
something.
Right, and maybe even have your iTunes, for example, in the vehicle. So as you're moving from car to car, your music, your calendar, your preferences follow you in this vehicle.
This thing looks about 2 pounds bigger than an iPod. I mean, this is really just a kind of a wraparound bubble of a car. What's the top speed?
Top speed, we haven't estimated yet. It's still a concept vehicle. It would still be a roadworthy vehicle.
Is all the technology available, or are you waiting for some breakthrough to make this producible?
There's no breakthroughs that are necessary. Battery technology is there, rapid recharge. We're using electric motors in the wheels so that we can get direct drive. So you have actually very good torque band ranges in this vehicle. And the car is lightweight, so we want to be able to have maximum range.
Phil Patton, you ready for a stackable car, grocery cart model?
Yeah, I want to pick them up just like the carts at the airport. You know, we put in our credit card and get the luggage card, and this has worked for bicycles. I think it's interesting. But I think it suggests also that the ideas we have of our relationship to the vehicle are changing. It's not the family vehicle, the country squire that Dad drives anymore,
mm-hmm.
but it's a personal device, not unlike a cell phone. And when everybody has to have one, you rethink the problem entirely. Of course, it's customizable, but some of the ideas that Ryan is talking about that they've worked on very interestingly up there, I think make a lot of sense for the mainstream auto companies to look at as well. Customizable, of course, but also something where we have much more variety. We have the big SUV for Dad, but we have a small one for young people because the numbers of registrations of vehicles have gone up so high. In fact, in New Jersey, there are actually more registered vehicles than there are registered drivers.
Amazing. Larry Webster, there's something very liberating about sort of a new understanding of transportation here where you're not loading up 10,000 pounds and choking the atmosphere every time you move around. But what about the anthropological piece of this? Do you think Americans will cotton on to this in significant numbers?
Well, you know, I can certainly understand wanting to do your part to conserve and help the environment, of course. But the thing is that some idea like that is obviously only going to work where you have a high population density. And we don't really have that in a lot of places in this country. Now, at one time we did, and you know, people found out when they could get a car, well, geez, I want to go where I can get some room. And so we're sort of in that model now, and you could say what you could say bad things about sprawl, and certainly has its detractors, but it's kind of been a choice for a lot of people that they want that room. They don't want to be crowded in a city where a car like that would work.
And yet, as the price of gas gets higher and we see what happens to the ozone, Dick Cheney says conservation is a personal decision, but it starts to look pretty attractive here. Michael's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. My question has to do with disability. I am a disabled person. I'm not confined to a wheelchair, but I have to use canes.
Okay.
It's very difficult for me to sit. It's very difficult for me to enter and exit a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And I need space when I get inside. Is there something of a hybrid minivan in the works, or are there smaller vehicles that are suited to people like me who, because of back injuries or other disabilities, have significant difficulty getting in and out of a car as well as riding in it?
Yeah, so you need room to maneuver in and out. You'd be happy for a small car once you got there. Larry, what do you say?
Well, there are certainly a lot of options. First thing is the hybrid option that you mentioned, the Ford Escape Hybrid, is kind of an SUV that's not a minivan, but it's a hybrid and gets great fuel economy. There's also numerous companies that will modify cars to make them easier for you to get in and out of. One I know, it's here in Kalamazoo, called Liberty Car Company, and they do stuff to PT Cruisers and things like that, which should be able to help you out.
Ryan Chin, along those same lines, as you look to the future, are you just building these stackable cars for the young and trim and fit and fully abled? I mean, these don't look like they'd be easy for for someone with crutches or canes to hop in and out of.
No, I think these cars are for everybody. In fact, there's a trend now for a lot of baby boomers to actually move back into the city. Their empty nest at home with no children in is too large. There is a trend for people moving back into the city. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is, how do we rethink the egress and ingress of a vehicle? It's very, very difficult. The whole ritual of getting into a car, especially a low vehicle, is very, very difficult, even for able-bodied
people.
What's
the option then? You're going to pop the whole top off, gull wing, what?
We had some extreme radical ideas in this area. One was to think of the seat as something wearable. For example, getting into the seat, and the seat actually embraces you like a mother holding a baby, for example. Could you make a seat that can articulate?
I would just stand there and reach up and grab my behind and pull me in or something?
Perhaps. Or even wear the seat and get into the vehicle. That's another way of doing it. The other aspect is, of course, the doors. There is a stigma in this country, I think, against sliding doors.
Yeah.
Most people think sliding doors are for minivans. But in Europe and other places, sliding doors actually work really well. There are a few anomalies to this, but I think sliding doors and other types of egress that we can think of might solve some of these problems.
Michael in Nashville, there's some practical advice for right now and some interesting hopes for the future there as well. Let me get one more call. Bruce from Waverly, Iowa. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Great
hi.
Show.
Thank you.
I just returned from a trip from Germany, and it's kind of the elephant in the room that, I drove a Peugeot wagon, mostly in-town driving, but it got up to 100 on the Autobahn with no problem. Turbo diesel got over 40, about 45 miles per gallon. And Opel, which is owned by General Motors, has a whole line of diesel, turbo diesel cars that get really high mileage, but you can't buy them in the United States.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be just an obvious answer to a lot of problems. I don't know why GM doesn't bring their Opel line to the United States. And when most people think of Opel, they think of the old Opel GT, but they're making some great-looking cars over there that we can't buy in the United States.
Bruce, it sounds like you're about to get run over by a Hummer there. But thanks for that. Let me turn to Phil Patton with that. Phil, what about it? I mean, Americans look go to Europe and look around and say, wait a minute, why? If we want these, why don't we have access to them? Is it because we just don't buy enough of them, so we don't deserve them?
No, part of it is our own desire to be green and clean works against us. These cannot be sold in California or in the seven northeast states that have California-like rules for environmental reasons.
Why not if they're so small and get such mileage?
Well, that's it, but they do have a certain amount of particulate pollution, which is not a good thing. But
so they're really not cleaner, you're saying, some of these?
Well, the diesel fuel beginning this year will have to be cleaner. The problems seem to be within solution about removing the rest of the particulates from diesel exhaust, and there's really a lot of work there. Diesel has an image, however, that is wrapped up in 18-wheelers and big sooty smokestacks. Today's turbo diesel with computer chips and so on is highly efficient and quite a clean machine. It's nearly half the cars in Europe are diesels, and it's something we ought to add to the food pyramid, the nutritional pyramid, at least, of our
car buffet here. We're almost out of time, Larry Webster. Let me quickly put the same thing to you. Can we get this big buffet of tiny cars on our roads here? Is it just a matter of Americans buying them and they'll come, or is there some other obstruction? We've just got 15 seconds.
I think diesels are coming. He's right. There's problems with emissions with those things, but otherwise they're fine. I think basically the gas engine is going to be the majority powertrain for the foreseeable future. The other problem is diesel fuel is not cheaper than gasoline here, and it is cheaper than gasoline in Europe. So really, like we've always said, you want to drive fuel economy, a higher fuel price, easy way to do it.
Well, there's a brave new world out there, and it's tiny. Larry Webster at Car and Driver, Phil Patton at the New York Times and ID Magazine, thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
And Ryan Chin from MIT's Media Lab working on the stackable concept car in the Smart Cities Project. We'll be watching for it, Ryan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Lots of images at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.